We're going to start with a picture. Christmas Day, 800 AD, this happened. I don't think it happened exactly like this. This is a painting of it by Raphael. This is the coronation of Charlemagne. On Christmas Day in 8800, Pope Leo III coronated Charles I, also known as Charles the Great, as the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. Charlemagne became the first Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. And you probably heard that phrase somewhere in your Western Civ class, but may not know much of what that's about. But let me just give you a little bit of frame of reference. At the time, in 800, the Muslims had, I think by then, had taken over Constantinople, had moved through northern Africa, coming up from Spain, and the attention of the Roman Church turned towards Europe, turned north, and to the west, so Europe and England. And what this event kind of signified was the kind of the marrying of church and state, that you have the Pope, the religious leader, saying to the king, you have the right to be the leader because I'm putting the crown on your head. And at the same time, the king thinking, why does this bozo think he's putting a crown in my head? I'm the king after all. He only lives because I say he lives. And so you have this interesting moment in church history. But what's important about this, if you were sitting in my Sunday school class, is that this marks the beginning historically of what we understand as Christendom. This is the extent of the Holy Roman Empire at its height. But we get the beginning of what we know now as Christendom. And you may have heard that phrase somewhere, Christendom. Christendom is the idea that we look at. So whenever you watch a movie that has like knights and kings and queens and any movie like that, except maybe if it's Monty Python, any other movie like that, is based on this idea of Christendom, that the church and the state and all of that is just one big thing. This distinction that we have, that we understand in our day, where there's a distinct church or churches in America, and then the government is something completely separate, that didn't exist in Christendom. In Christendom, all of life was all one thing. All of life pertained to the church. The church had something to say about every part of one's life. In that sense, we're going to talk about this idea, everything in Christendom was spiritual. And then, again, if you sat through my Sunday school class, we talked about René Descartes, and he said, cogito ergo sum, which means, I think, therefore I am. And this we recognize as one of those turning points in the rise of the Enlightenment and the age of reason. And what Descartes was saying is Descartes, up to that time, what we believe, the authority on everything, resided in the church. Everything is spiritual. The church tells us what to believe and how to believe it and why we should believe. Descartes comes along and says, I'm going to doubt that. I'm going to doubt everything. And at the end of all his doubts, he gets to the place of his own reason. And we have the Age of Enlightenment that can really be really simple understanding of what this all means, is that the mind is what we really are, and that the body is superfluous. That it's how we think that's important. And so we get a division, and we get the life of the mind, and we get our physical life is separate. And that creeps into our theology. And so you hear us talk about, sometimes I've used the same language myself, we talk about my spiritual life, as if there are parts of my life that are spiritual, and they're over here, and there are other parts of my life that have nothing to do with spirituality. We talk about somebody in the first service talking about my spiritual life consists of, like, I do my devotions in the morning and then I stop doing that and I go on and do the rest of the day for me. Or the distinction between I do one day, I go to church and I worship and I do that, but then there's the rest of life over here. And often what creeps into this kind of thinking is a distinction between the two. And so as we work through this series that we've been working through, for those of you that are new to us, we turned 5 over on Palm Sunday, the week before Easter, and as a church, 5 years old. And we're taking some time and going back to, what are those things that make us uniquely Imago Dei Church? Well, one of our directives, and the last one we're going to be looking at, is that we believe all of life, food, friends, work, money, pleasure, sleep, is spiritual. And we do not fragment our lives. We live with a growing understanding that everything we do relates to God. So swimming against the stream of the Enlightenment, saying, you know what, this distinction between mind and body, or mind and physical and everything else, trying to swim against that stream and not exactly get to the point of Christendom, but come back to a place where we see all of life as spiritual. So for just a minute, before I say much more, what do you see in here? What seems important as you've seen this before? I've put it up here on the screen before. What jumps out at you? What seems significant? What's important? What parts do you really like? What makes you nervous? Good. Unnaturally cleaved. I like that. I'm cold. Anybody else? The air conditioning was running. I just went, before the service started, I caught the air conditioning running again. I keep shutting it off this morning and it keeps turning itself back on. But I think I've won now. Nothing a cleaver wouldn't fix. Anybody else? What stands out to you here? Nothing. Awesome. A lot of space to teach into. All right? Turn your Bibles to Genesis chapter 1. I didn't put the page number on the screen if you need it. It's page 1. I like how in these Bibles it really is page 1, because in some Bibles all the intro stuff is... But this one, it's actually page 1. We're going to start this morning by this creation poem. There's actually two, I don't know if you all know this, but there's two accounts of the creation. The first one is Genesis chapter 1, this poem of wild celebration of the creation. And then if you flip the page and look at Genesis chapter 2, verse 4, it starts another one. This is an account of the heavens and the earth when they were created. And so there's this second account in Genesis chapter 2. And you can some ways put the two together, and some ways they stand opposed to each other, but whatever, that's for another day. We're going to deal with this one written by Moses eventually, but originally seems to have been an oral tradition. Now, if you grow up in an oral tradition, what you do at night once you put your kids to bed is you don't sit down and watch Law and Order. You tell stories. You sit around. It's like when you go camping with friends and you sit around a fire and you tell stories. That's what you do every night. Is when you don't have that, you talk. And especially in pre-literate societies, you don't go into your own personal space and read. You tell stories. And so it's easy to imagine that for hundreds of years, as people gathered around the fire at night, and maybe there were children there, and they would say, "Tell me the story of our ancestor Abraham. Tell me the story of this myth. Tell me this story again. Tell me the story of creation again." And somebody in the clan would have gotten up, probably one of the older males in this era would have stood up and would have recited this poem as an account of creation. And in oral tradition, what happens is things get fine-tuned as they go. They get better and better. So, for example, almost every week we podcast the second service because in theory, it should be better than the first, all right? Because all the bad jokes I tried out in the first service and nobody laughed at, they all get taken out. And the things that I set off the cuff that people laughed at in the first service, I keep in, you know? So theoretically, it doesn't always hold true, but most of the time, the second service is a little bit more finely tuned. And if we had 6 or 7 services, it would get more and more tuned as we go along, right? You understand that. If you've told a story, like let's say the story of how you met your spouse, that gets better and better with age, right? Like you know how to tell it better and better, and you know the ways to say it, and you know what gets the laugh and what makes you look like the hero and your spouse looks like the goat. She broke up with me 4 times. Just 2. So that's what this Genesis poem is. And I just want to address up front. I know that some of you come from traditions where really the only time we turn to the first page in our Bibles is when it's time to argue about literal creation or evolution and those kinds of things. And that's just not important for us at all this morning. That has nothing to do with how we're going to read this morning. What we're going to do is I want to read this and then try to unpack what it says. And so for some of you, you've read this many times in your life. I want you, if you can, this is no pressure, just an invitation. If you want to just close your eyes and listen, because sometimes we've read it so many times, it loses it. And so I'm going to try to read it in a way that's faithful as best as I can to the idioms, to the words. There's words and phrases that keep on showing up over and over again as this poem got developed and got better and better, I'm sure. So I'm going to read it that way. If you want to close your eyes, I'm going to read all of Genesis chapter 1 and into Genesis chapter 2, because whoever decided where the chapters went, I can't remember the guy's name, it was a stupid break to stop at the end of the 6th day and then start the 7th day in chapter 2. So I'm going to finish on down through the account of creation. So I'll read. Genesis chapter 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty, and darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and he separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. And God said, let there be a vault between the waters to separate water from water. So God made the vault and separated the water under the vault from the water above it. And it was so. God called the vault sky. And there was evening and there was morning the second day. And God said, let the water under the sky be gathered to one place and let dry ground appear. And it was so. God called the dry ground land and the gathered waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let the land produce vegetation, seed-bearing plants and trees on the land that bear fruit with seed in it according to their various kinds. And it was so. The land produced vegetation, plants bearing seed according to their kinds, and trees bearing fruit with seed in it according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning the third day. And God said, let there be lights in the vault of the sky to separate the day from the night, and let them serve as signs to mark sacred times and days and years, and let them be lights in the vault of the sky to give light on the earth. And it was so. God made two great lights, the greater light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night. He also made the stars. God set them in the vault of the sky to give light on the earth, to govern the day and the night, and to separate light from darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning the fourth day. And God said, let the water teem with living creatures, and let the birds fly above the earth across the vault of the sky. So God created the great creatures of the sea and every living thing that with which the water teems and that moves about in it according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them and said, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the water in the seas and let the birds increase on the earth. And there was evening and there was morning the fifth day. And God said, let the land produce living creatures according to their kinds, the livestock, the creatures that move along the ground, and the wild animals, according to its kind. And it was so. God made the wild animals according to their kinds, and the livestock according to their kinds, and all the creatures that move along the ground according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let us make mankind in our image and our likeness so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the air, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground. Then God said, I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food, and to all the beasts of the earth and all the birds in the sky and all the creatures that move along the ground, everything that has the breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food. And it was so. God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning the sixth day. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all of their vast array. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing, so on the seventh day he rested from all his work. Then God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. There's a lot of different ways of going, of interpreting this passage. In fact, passages like this, we not only have our Christian tradition, but we have rabbinic tradition that stretches back thousands of years before our own. And so when we start talking about the creation and when we share that narrative with Jews, there's a long, long, long history of interpretation and a long history. I was got into this week to some reading about the numerology of Genesis 1, and it has 3 and 7 and this, and add this and take away that and subtract these and it means this. And there's all kinds of ways of slicing and dicing. But just one point I want to make this morning about how we think of everything as spiritual has to do with kind of the nature of the creation itself. So in this passage, it starts with God. In the beginning, God. Now, at the time of Moses' writing, the understanding of people in his time and his era was mostly that the gods were kind of like superhuman beings, like what we think of as almost like comic book characters. The gods were kind of like humans, but greater to some degree. And so when Moses encounters this God that he writes of in Exodus chapter 3 at the burning bush and says, "Who are you?" Moses is looking for some kind of a, "Give me some markers. Are you the God of war or of the sky or oceans? Or tell me what the nature, your nature is." And God responds at that point with, "I am. I'm not any of those things. I'm just pure essence." And of course, again, with all these stories, we have years and years of rabbinic tradition. Oop, I forgot to write I. I am. Maybe just the simplest way we can say this morning is that God responds with just essence. There are no words to put what I am. I'm just, and we can start filling that in. And I think the rest of scriptures do really well at then filling that in of all the care and trying to paint a picture of this almost incomprehensible understanding of I am. But when we read the poem, so we get this sense that God exists, but then we see a little bit narrowing of the definition that it's the Spirit of God that hovers over the face of the waters. And so we get this idea that God is Spirit. And then we hear throughout the passage the voice of God speaking into the creation. And he says, and you heard me read, he says, "And it is so." And he says this, "And it is so." And he says this, "And it is so." And then finally, if we would have kept reading into the second account of the creation, we would have gotten this understanding of the breath of God breathing into creation, okay? So we get this idea that God, none of these things, breath, voice, spirit, I am, none of these things are what we would understand as physical. They're all spiritual. We get that idea. On the other side of this poem, we have something else working, and we have the creation itself. And so in day one, we get the separation of light and dark. What's day two? Help me out. Sky. Separation of earth and sky. What's day three? Land and sea. And with the land and sea, we get the idea, somebody said to me in the break today, the idea of land and sea, when the land, we get vegetation here as well. And in the vegetation, it's important to note the idea of seeds, that in the creation is put the possibility for recreation, that I'm going to put trees on the ground, on the land, and then those trees are going to be seeds so that these trees can recreate. What I've done here, these trees will keep doing. You keep putting the seed in the ground, they keep recreating. What's on day four? Sun, moon, and stars. I'll start writing even before you say it, all right? We're going to set this one aside for just a minute. I'm going to come back to this, okay? What's on day five then? Aquatic life? Right. If you were saying aquatic life, you were correct. And then on the sixth day, we get landforms, right? All these animals that live on the land. So all these things, we see, just a note, that we move from the most abstract, light and day, something that's so easy to understand. You don't need any degree or any understanding to understand light and dark. But as we move through the creation, things get more complicated life forms. Until we get to this one then, well, this is the most complicated. We get to human beings who are formed in the same way, created in the same way, so that they are physical, yes. We have physical bodies. We know our physical bodies, right? But at the same time, the breath of God is breathed into us, and we have spirit as well. And so unique in creation stands human beings who are both spiritual and physical. I was reading this week or listening to another pastor say in the Hebrew, and I, as far as I know, he's correct. In the Hebrew, there is no word for spiritual life because it's all, when you're a human being, all of life is spiritual. I'll say this again later. I'll point at it now, but remind me to say it later. That when you're a human being, the idea of life being spiritual, it's not like some of us are spiritual and some of us aren't. We are all spiritual. The question is how much we pay attention to it. And we'll come back to that in a bit. So we look at this, or I'm going to come back to this in just a couple minutes. But human beings then occupy this very unique space in the creation where we're the space. And if I wanted to keep preaching long, long, long time today about it, but I have a wedding to do this afternoon, so I'm going to hold back. We would point to the incarnation as the place where God stands in this place as well. And God, the language of Philippians, he lays aside spirit and puts on flesh. And I would talk about that in someday in the language of John the Revelator, the language of having new bodies some days. Sometimes in our Christian world, we almost talk about someday as if it's disembodied existence, and yet the trajectory of Scripture is always towards new bodies. Not that we're spirits floating around somewhere, but that we will get new bodies, bodies much more like back to the creation bodies, the ones that aren't broken and sick and deformed and all those things, that we get new bodies. It's never disembodied existence, because what it means to be a human being is to be spirit and flesh both. And what does God say about this creation? He says it's good. He doesn't say, that'll have to do. I don't know what else to do with them, so I'm going to stick them in a body. I'm going to stick that mind in a body that'll get them around for a while so someday I can liberate the mind. That's not Christian theology. The understanding is that the human is everything. It's both and to take one out means I'm somehow not human. So C.S. Lewis says it way more eloquently than I. Shocker. He says God never meant man to be a purely spiritual creature. That is why he uses material things like bread and wine to put the new life into us. We may think this rather crude and unspiritual. God does not. He invented eating. He likes matter. He invented it. All right? And you could put, he invented eating, you could put a whole bunch of things in there, right? This understanding that we are spiritual, but we're physical as well. You think your wife, I stole that off her Facebook page. All right? I was going to credit her if she was here, but I went with C.S. Lewis instead. So we believe that all of life, the food that we eat, the time that we spend with friends, the time that we work, what we do with money, what we do with pleasure and sleep is spiritual. That list, we could add everything in there. This was just some kind of a sampling that when we were writing this, when we wanted to get some things in there. Food, for me, obviously you all been here long enough, or many of you have been here long enough to know my love of food. And I know we all love food. It's not just the eating of it. That's a good part of it, but the making of it, the handling of it, the growing of it, you know, and I hope that you all got your gardens in, because this is, as much as the rain stinks for everything else, last year was a little hard on the rain, and this year it's good, and not to brag, but my tomato plants are already like this tall, so that is exactly bragging. My tomato plants are this tall. I'm going to own my bragging, all right? Anyway, the time we spend with friends and work, we're going to talk about all these a little bit more later. Money, we're going to talk about more specifically next week. Pleasure is one that specifically in our American Puritan traditions, we have a hard time with relating pleasures to God, don't we? Like we use the word guilt in front of our pleasures a lot, right? That if we like it too much, it's somehow a guilty pleasure. And we usually don't really mean things that we really should feel guilty about. We refer to things that we do feel guilty about, and we don't know why we feel guilty about them. And then sleep. I want to talk about sleep for just a second before I flip my chart. I was in a retreat setting a couple years ago, and the director of the retreat told us that if you go off to pray on retreat in your time of silence and you fall asleep, has anybody fallen asleep in prayer besides me? I just want to see who doesn't raise their hand. Are you kidding? All right. She said that maybe this is an incredibly spiritual act even at that point. That it recognizes the limitations of a human body. And if I go into the presence of God and I need to sleep, maybe that's what I need to do so that I can then give my attention and focus later to God. That sleep recognizes our humanness. One of the ways of looking at the creation poem, by the way, is that Hebrew writers often wrote in a chiastic pattern. So here's what we usually do, all right? When we write an essay, for example, there's generally speaking two ways of going about an essay. The one is, I always use the words backwards, is it inductive, where you state what you're going to say. No, deductive. You state what you're going to say, then you prove it, right, in the essay. Inductive is the other way. You make your proofs and you lead them on a journey till you get to the point where you say, this is what I'm saying. Hebrew writers didn't do either one. They often put it right in the middle. And then they wrote their poem in such a way to give you clues to look out for, hey, look for the middle. And so there is a way to do this with the poem, and we can take time to do that. We're not going to. But if you do that, you land on day four as the middle. And in the middle of this poem is this thing about the sun, moon, and stars and the rhythm of day and night, and that there's day and then there's night. And then you get this bigger rhythm at the end of the poem about there's 6 days of work and then there's 1 day of rest. And then you get into the giving of the law and there's 6 years of work and there's 1 year of rest. And there's this rhythm back and forth that much of what it seems to be concerned about is how we go about the rhythms of our life. And sleep then, I'm sorry, I'm doing a whole riff on sleep, but it's just interesting to me that then sleep becomes part of this. When I give my body the rest it needs, maybe that too is a spiritual act of recognizing the limitations of what it means to be a human being. Maybe sleep is spiritual. I think it is. In the same way that I might eat too much or not enough, I sleep too much or not enough. I think for most of us in our modern era, we don't sleep enough, right? And mostly related to electricity, because we can turn on the light, TV, phone, and we keep ourselves up doing things that are just foolish and abandoning sleep. That's just a riff. So the question this morning then, and where we're going to spend the remainder of our time, is what does it look like then if everything is spiritual? How far can we push that? And I just want to give you three ideas, because I'm a pastor and you have to have three. There was just three that came to my head that seemed like things we should flesh out. The first one, I think it's fairly obvious, right? Everything means everything. Let me draw this. I've said it different times in here that when it's like the 1st of January or the beginning of a new school year, or there's other times in life where this is important, where you like take stock of your life. You know what I'm talking about? Those times where you're like, all right, what are my goals? What am I after? We do this in our marriage, like in our anniversary usually, like how's the last year been? What's good? Where do we need to, you know, what do we need to work on? So I say that I often picture my life almost as a series of dials on a car, you know? So like these dials have like titles like, you know, what kind of dad am I being? Am I giving time to my kids? Am I being a good father? Am I not yelling at them? You know, so the dial's like this way, you know. And then this is a dad called, a dial called husband. And how am I being as a husband? You know, like I give myself 50-50. And then there's one maybe that says something about exercise. And that one, usually I can just look at how many times am I working out a week. And, you know, a couple weeks ago it was like six. And with all this rain, it's been like two or three the last couple weeks. So it's kind of down here. And how am I eating? And I could talk about, you know, how I spend my money. And so I could just keep on making these dials for all these areas of life. And it's easy in some of these, like I think all the ones I've mentioned so far, we can see the spirituality of those, right? And understand that, oh, yeah, all those things, there's a way of, in a spiritual way, if everything's spiritual, there's a way that God is trying to speak to me in the midst of being a dad. There's things he's inviting me into, behaviors, but also things I'm learning about God because I'm a dad. This isn't just about making moral choices, but it's about God's invitation to meet me in that moment. And even in my moments of frustration, to meet me in that. And so as a dad, there's, and you can see how all these, I don't need to belabor this. But the question comes, if everything means everything, I probably, and I know I do, I have some things that live out here on the outside of the circle. That the challenge, if everything means everything, if everything is spiritual, the challenge is to take these things and start moving them into the sphere of what is spiritual. Like I said in the introduction, we do this a lot. We say that we act as if certain parts of my life are spiritual and certain parts aren't. And so we have a spiritual life and we have the rest of our life. And so for some of us, somebody was saying that they, in the first service, they grew up in a tradition where it seemed as if there were certain words you didn't use on Sunday and a certain way of acting on Sunday. But then when you went to work on Monday morning, all that stuff didn't matter because church on Sunday was spiritual. Work was something that laid outside of that. That's this out here. Does that make sense? So let me point at a few examples. About 2 weeks ago, we were with some friends, and I said, it was just kind of in the course of conversation, we were talking about some other stuff, and I said, you know, like, I think I've got like 3 or 4 vacation days left this year, and our fiscal year ends at the end of June, so it's coming up, and I don't think I'm going to, I don't see where I'm going to have a chance to use up my vacation days. And my friend got really upset at me, and she said, you know, you deserve those days. It's important for you to take those days. For your family, you should be taking those days. And what she challenged me on a little bit was to think of this as spiritual, not just as, I don't think of vacation days as spiritual. It's just, it's vacation days, you know? Like, who thinks about vacation days that way? But if everything means everything, and if everything is spiritual, there's probably something about that to me. There's an invitation from God to think about my rhythms, and why is it that I think I have to be here so bad? How is it that I think if I take my hand off the wheel for 2 seconds, the whole ship is going to wheel ship? I think I just mixed metaphors again. Whatever, right? I think the old phrase is take your hand off the till, but I don't even know what that means, so I was trying to make up something different. Do you understand? That she was challenging me to think in terms of my family and who I am and why I think that I shouldn't be taking those days, and to think of that as spiritual. And so is it possible that if I do, or how I do, and then what I do with those days, is that a spiritual thing to think about? Is Jesus inviting me into something there? We could do this with a lot of other areas. Some of you grew up in a house that was... politics. Can I talk about politics for a minute? Last service, it got really awkward when I started talking about politics, because it just does. Because some of us in this room grew up in a home where we were Republican first and Christian second, right? Or vice versa. We were Democrats first, Christian second. And we wouldn't actually maybe say that, but when we started talking about those kinds of things, our faith was here. This was Sunday morning. This is politics now. And not just the content of what we believe about those things, but the way in which we hold those. Does that make sense? So there's the content of what I believe, and then there's the manner in which I go about holding that. So one is to say, you know what, I can believe this, 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 and this, and I'm not going to tell you what I think about anything. And so don't get your hopes up, all right? I can believe all these things, and I've known people in my life. Facebook is a great place to see this. People that you know, that you think are otherwise good, decent, kind Christian people, but somehow when it comes to talking about this, we've made this not spiritual, so we can say anything we want about the people on the other side of the political aisle, right? You see it on the news all the time. You've heard it on Facebook. People that claim the name of Jesus and claim that we're supposed to be becoming like Jesus, we're supposed to be becoming more kind, compassionate, loving, all those things. But somehow when it becomes about this, then we get to call people jerks and idiots and morons and whatever other names we want to call them because they disagree with us politically. And my contention is that if everything means everything, not only what I think about politics should be influenced by Jesus, but maybe how I even talk about those things should have something to do with my spirituality. Is that fair? And then if we get into the issues, if we call ourselves follower of Jesus and we're talking about immigration or gun control or whatever, taxes, the poor, if somehow the kingdom of God and Jesus don't become a part of that conversation, what we've effectively done is said, you know what? Jesus has nothing to say about those issues. Jesus lives out here. I read a post, and you may agree or disagree this week. I just thought it was interesting, all right? Again, not tipping my hand. And it was a post written on Pentecost last Sunday. So remember last week was Pentecost. We celebrate the unification, putting Babel back together, people reading in all the different languages. And I hope you all liked that last week. I loved it, all right? So we'll probably do it again. If you didn't like it, I don't want to know. But I read a post about it, and it was connecting Pentecost to immigration policies. And asking the question, if Christians are supposed to be about reunification and the dissolving of languages, what does that have to say about immigration? And I think whatever your conclusion to that is, it's a good place to start the conversation. So the question is politics, does that get moved in to everything being spiritual? How about another one? I know that some of you think I'm making this up and it's a cliche, but I've heard people say this about the creation, about the planet, about the environment, to say, you know what? We believe that God's going to burn it all up anyway, so whatever. I don't know if you all have heard people say that. I've read this. I've heard people say things pretty close to this. But if everything is spiritual and God calls the creation good, that should impact how I live, right? I can't just say, you know what? I'm going to throw this garbage out my window because it doesn't matter. It matters. How I live, how I relate to the creation matters. And we could, again, we could do a whole nother sermon down that road. I'm just going to tease it there. I want to give one more, since I have one more empty circle. I'm going to make the same confession I made in the first service, that I find myself as I get older, when I'm watching TV, to watch less sports and watch more science shows. I think I'm becoming a science geek, all right? And I don't know what happened to me. I used to be cool, all right? But I really don't care about the Blackhawks. I'm sorry. I'd rather watch Nova. And so I know that hurts some of you. My oldest two sons and I, that's become kind of our thing, is to watch Nova together. And we think it's so much fun. Science Now, that's cool. There's a new show called Brain Games on the National Geographic Channel, which I don't get, but they showed an episode on Fox the other night. Wow, so neat. I fell asleep watching it last night because it was late, but I'll finish it. We were talking in my Sunday school class this morning about the French Revolution and the rise of Enlightenment, and that what happened in the Enlightenment was the shearing off of reason is over here, and in the words of Tim slash Ted, that faith now after the Enlightenment, after Descartes, I think, therefore I am, reason was God, and faith lived down the street and around the corner, that the two were separated, that there was science and there was church. And I'll just say, for me, I was raised in that camp. Like, science was the bad guys. Scientists were bent on destroying Christianity is the narrative I was taught growing up. And I would say that one of the journeys in my life that I find really invigorating, I get really excited about, is this understanding that science, too, is spiritual. And whether it's... I love, is it Brian, what's his middle name? Green, the guy, the Elegant Universe guy, and quantum physics. I find this stuff incredibly beautiful, and it leads me to places of worship. I don't know about anybody else. It gets me all ramped up, all right? I'm going to stop because I'm going to get crazy, and you all think I'm nuts enough. So I'm going to move on. If everything means everything, if everything is spiritual and everything really does mean everything, the ongoing conversation at Imago Dei Church is, what about this area? What about this? What about this? Which leads me to my second thing, is the overcompensation effect. So if everything is spiritual, then this becomes a problem for me. And here's the problem. Let me explain it this way. I think many of you know, about a month ago, I ran my first marathon. So from January 1st up through the end of April, I was running a lot. It got up, the training program I was on, I was running close, well, in the low 50s per week, like 50 some miles, between 45 and 55 miles a week. That's a lot of time on the road, all right? And while I was doing it, I had thoughts that I was going to lose lots of weight. You want to know how much weight I lost in the 4 months? I added 5 pounds. I gained weight during my marathon training. And I found out, talking to other people that run marathons, pretty normal. You know why? Overcompensation effect. Here's how it goes. Charlie got up this morning and ran 12 miles. Charlie has dinner and decides, beer for dinner on a Tuesday night? Yeah, I ran 12 miles this morning. I eat my dinner. I decide it tastes good. Do I want more? Yes, I want more. Should I have more? I ran 12 miles this morning. Yes. And then dinner's over and I decide I want a beer, or I want a dessert, or a second dessert, or another little snack before dinner. What do I say to all those opportunities? Yes. Why? Because I ran 12 miles. You're getting it, right? And so I compensate myself for the good behavior that I did. I ran 12 miles. But what happens is, we never stop with compensation, pure and simple. Unless you track calories, we almost always will overcompensate for our exercise. This is the challenge. If you don't exercise and track calories, I'm just telling you dieting advice here. If you don't do both, you will overcompensate almost all the time. I walked for 10 minutes. I should have a double helping of dessert. It doesn't work like that, all right? That's not how it works. Any amount of exercise does not equal any amount of, there's a finite amount of exercise and calories and whatever. I should get off the dieting thing, all right? But we all do this, right? So let me tell you a story. It doesn't make me look good, but I'll tell it anyway, all right? I'm not condoning this behavior. Early on in our marriage, Jennifer and I made a deal, and it's one that we still live by. It's still the deal, all right? For 17 years later. The deal is this. I cook, she cleans, right? When it comes to dinner. I'm happy to cook dinner. I like it. It's how if I come home from a long day, that's how I relax. I like to have a knife in my hand, music playing, making food. I'm happy, all right? I hate cleaning up the kitchen. I clean as I go. I'm a neat cook in general. But after dinner, I'm done. So what often happens is, let's say I've come in from a long day's work and I say, what's for dinner? She says, tacos. I say, fine. She's got the meat already sitting out. I go ahead and I make tacos, in which I always add a ton of onions to the hamburger meat because it sneaks onions into our kids' diet and bulks up the hamburger meat and they don't even know it's there. Just a little tip, all right? So that's my little secret, family tacos. And sometimes we throw like bell peppers and stuff in there too, because once you do the taco seasoning and stuff, they don't notice that either. So that was a total distraction. Oh, and she says, so I want you to make tacos. I want you to make fresh guacamole because, you know, love guacamole. And there's nothing like real guacamole. And so I do so. And I do so happily. I'm fully engaged. It's wonderful. Then dinner gets over. And because I just did this good husband thing, I came home and I did the dinner and I did really good. What happens after dinner is I go to the deal. I start compensating with the deal. Well, I made dinner, so I should not have to clean up dinner. Fair enough? Fair. But that often then goes into the kids are getting put to bed and she needs help getting them all to bed. But I made dinner. I worked on dinner for an hour, and so I think I get to sit here and watch TV while she does dinner. And then kids need help with homework, but I made dinner, right? And we do this, and you're all laughing at me, but you do it too, right? We overcompensate ourselves. We reward ourselves. Rewarding ourselves is good, and it's okay to reward ourselves, right? But what happens is the psychological idea is that we often reward ourselves plus a lot, and we over-reward ourselves. So in the case of me training for a marathon, rewarding yourself because you do a long run, good. Rewarding yourself too much, you put on weight while you're training for a marathon, which is really, really common from everybody I've talked to. Almost everybody I've talked to is like, oh yeah, me too. When I trained, I did that too. The danger when we start talking about everything is spiritual, one of the things that we have to struggle with is we all like to pick an area and say, I do this really well. So if you're of the school where you get up every day and pray, or you get up every day and read the Bible or whatever it is, hey, I do this over here really, really good. Well, what about this over here? Well, not so much, but look what I do really nice. I'm really good at this, all right? And we tend to focus on the areas that we're really good at. And this is where, remember how I took these five directives and laid the circles all on top of each other? This is where we need the community around us to say, yeah, 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 I know that you do this. But what about this? What about vacation? You're doing all this good over here, but what about this? Is this spiritual too or not? And we need the community to help us pull us back in and say, if everything is spiritual, you can't pick one out and say, ha-ha, I'm good at that. I'm awesome at that. That's not okay, because they're all spiritual. Does that make sense? The last one is this. If everything is spiritual, then right here, right now, God. That's not to be confused with the Van Halen album. So I put God on the end of it, because in the rabbinic tradition, when Moses is invited up on the mountain to receive the law, God invites him to come up on the mountain and be on the mountain. And in the rabbinic tradition, the idea developed that the idea was that Moses was supposed to go up there, and then what was Moses supposed to do? Nothing. Just be with God. Be in the moment with God. Where God is on the mountain, go be with God on the mountain. I don't want to be too melodramatic here, but we have a problem, don't we? We have a problem with being in any given moment. The Cubs game started just a couple minutes ago, and I need to check Facebook because somebody posted something. That's good. We have a problem focusing because we haven't checked email either in a couple minutes. And Dollar Shave Club is sending my next razors tomorrow. That's good. And what I was saying was, is we have a hard time focusing because we spend so much time tethered to everything. And it's been at least a minute since I checked Facebook, and I have to go back and check it again to see if anybody else. Oh, more people. Oh no, that uncolored there. And I got off this thing, and I. All right, somebody love Rock Church. Awesome. I'll like that. You see the problem we have? We have this problem in our culture, and it's not just the phones. Some of you are feeling very high and mighty right now because I don't have a smartphone. But it's television, and it's everything else that competes for our attention. And we have a hard time sometimes being right here, right now, where we are. My sister told me a couple years ago, and I still want to do this, haven't done it. She saw, probably on Pinterest, let me go look. somebody that had a basket by their front door, and they had a sign next to the basket that says, be with who you're with, leave your phones here at their house, which I love that idea of when you're here, drop your phone and be with who you're with. If you want to be with your phone, don't be with your phone at my house. Go be with your phone wherever you and your phone like to go on a date. I'm not claiming this as somebody who's got this figured out. I'm as bad as everybody else. But if God is omnipresent, if everything is spiritual, if God is inviting us into every moment as a moment where we can know God, then we have to be with God in those moments. I like to do this thing sometimes when I'm... You ever have those things on your calendar where you're really looking forward to it? Maybe it's a vacation or a party or something where you've been looking forward to it for a long time. And I'll do this afternoon with this couple. So they'll walk up the aisle and they'll get up here and they've got like 20 people standing up on both sides. And they'll get up here eventually and there's been a lot of chaos and it's been raining all day. So I'm sure they're stressed out about pictures and all that stuff. And they'll get up here and they'll stand right here and they'll be looking at me. And we'll have just done the pronouncement where I say, who gives this woman? And her dad will say, I do. And or her mother and I, and they'll do the thing. And they're standing here, and they're surrounded by their friends, and they're expecting the church to be packed full of people today. And if you've ever been to a wedding that I do, the first thing that I'll say to them is exhale, breathe. Be in this moment. Because your mind is going 1,000 miles a minute and you want to be at the reception and you want to be on your honeymoon and you're worried about this thing and you're on this thing and you were running and racing to get in here. Be here, now, where God is. God isn't waiting for you on Sunday morning at church or someplace else or someplace there or this thing or that thing. But if everything is spiritual, God is with us at all times, everywhere, just waiting for us to acknowledge him. It's not that God has left us. It's that we are usually so busy we don't notice God. Somebody in the first service said, you know, many of us grew up in traditions where it was a list of rules. Do this, do that, pray this thing, read this scripture. That's the spiritual stuff you do. Put money in the plate at church, do that, you know, serve at church, whatever the list was. We do those things and we were good. And one of the scary things about this idea that everything is spiritual is that if everything is spiritual, it's not so simple as a checklist of things to do. That there's always another invitation to notice God and to ask, what is God, what is Jesus drawing me into here? Sometimes that is a moral issue. Sometimes it is a thing where Jesus is drawing me in and saying, what about this? And what about your behavior here? What about your vacation day? Sometimes it's just to know that God is pleased. I started to say with the couple to breathe. I try to do this when I've looked forward to something. Like, let's say I was at a party a couple weeks ago that I look forward to every year. It's a fun party. And I try to, when I'm at parties, at some point during the time, to just kind of even step back from everybody for a minute and stop talking, which for me, that's hard. And to stop talking and just to notice and just to be. And to know that God smiles when human beings are celebrating and there's good and there's pleasure and it's good. Not that we should always have pleasure, but you know, there's goodness in this moment too. And so that's the invitation this morning, is where is God calling you? What areas of your life have you set apart as saying, you know what? This one's not spiritual. It doesn't really count because I'm doing these things. And part of the discussion and the invitation this morning at Imago Dei Church is to ask yourself, what do I treat as not spiritual that's really spiritual? If we stand in this place, if we stand in this place as beings that are totally physical and we're spiritual as well, what does it mean to stand there and to know God wherever we may find God?